This is Digital Story Podcast number 701, August 20th, 2019. Today's theme is The Art of Mistakes and Miscalculations. I'm Derek Story. Mistakes are sometimes in the eye of the beholder. An off-center subject may be viewed by one person as a poor composition and seen as dynamic by another. After visiting the exhibition, Don't, Photography and the Art of Mistakes at San Francisco Museum of Modern Art, I have five techniques that can be dazzling to some folks and head-scratching to others. Tune in and see which camp you fall into. So this was a terrific exhibit at SF MoMA, and I sort of stumbled on it. I was there to see something else, and I discovered this exhibit, and it really blew my mind. I mean, there were many of my favorite photographers there, Dorothea Lange, Stieglitz, and so forth. And the show really was taking the concepts that photographers had held as rules, steadfast rules, for so long. Now, of course, this was quite a while ago. This was in the early days of photography when these rules were established. And then following generations of photographers who said, things have changed, our tools have changed, our aesthetic has changed, and maybe those rules are meant to be broken. And that's what this was all about. And that's what I'm going to talk about in the first story of today's podcast. So I want to start by reading you the opening text to this exhibit at SF MoMA, because I think it frames the conversation very well. Here we go. In the late 19th and early 20th centuries, proscriptive texts by self-proclaimed photography experts proliferated in amateur manuals and periodicals. The next generation saw the rise of photographers who challenged these rules and strictures. Pairing modernist images by artists including Man Ray, Florence Henry, and Lisette Model with historical documents, this exhibition examines the shifting definitions of good and bad photography while considering how taste evolved during this transformative period for the medium. Pretty good stuff, huh? And, you know, that evolution continues. So they're taking, a slice of time right here for this, you know, evolving away from early 20th century. But, you know, we're going through it right now. And what's so interesting to me as we go over these different points is that what was challenging then is still alive and challenging today. In other words, as much as things have changed in photography, so many things have not. This will make a lot more sense to you once I get into five of these techniques that I call could be wonderful, okay? And oh, by the way, this show runs at San Francisco MoMA through December 1st. So if you're in the city, I highly recommend visiting the Museum of Modern Art anyway and seeing this show in particular. It's well worth your time. It's a delightful afternoon. Great place to hang out. Good food there. Great coffee. I mean, you just want to be there, okay? Just want to be there. All right, so let's get in to these five techniques that could be wonderful. That could be wonderful. All right, here we go. First one, off-framing. Off-framing. So in the early days of photography, tripods were required because of the low sensitivity of the photo medium. In other words, you had really slow glass or film or whatever it happened to be. Because the cameras were on a tripod, then those compositions, they tended to be squared up and, you know, very realistic and perfect, right? Perfect in terms of, you know, all the lines being perpendicular and all that good stuff. As film speeds increased and handheld photography became more common, so did composing mistakes and victories, for that matter. And what I mean by that is, so now we're holding the cameras, not on a tripod. So yeah, sometimes we get things lined up perfectly, but sometimes we're holding the camera and as we're lining things up, we accidentally press the shutter. Sometimes we're just terrible at lining things up for a variety of reasons. Sometimes we're not trying to line things up. So taking the camera off the tripod, which was the big move, then really led to some of this off framing. Now, my favorite off frame image, well, there I have a number of them, but one of my favorites, I should say, and you should definitely look this up. I may go ahead and put it in the show notes, so you may hop over there and take a look at it there, but it's easy to find. It's by Dorothea Lange, and it's called Little Man Stepping Off a Cable Car. And I just love this shot, because in the upper left-hand corner, she has basically the guy's feet and legs, and you can see that he's stepping off something. And then by the title, you know that it's a cable car, but it's up in the upper left-hand corner. So you don't have the rest of his body, and you have kind of this open space below him, which is perfect, right? Because the energy is flowing from the upper corner downward. So he needs space to land, so to speak. And it would be considered a mistake at one point in photography history, and at a later date, this wonderful dynamic image. Now, I think what's interesting is that if we stood there in the museum, and by the way, this shot is there at the MoMA. If we stood there in the museum and asked people as they came by, what do you think of this shot? I think some people would go, I love this shot. This is really interesting and it's fresh and it's dynamic and it has, you know, this great energy. But I would guarantee you that other people would go, well, she missed, right? She missed. I don't know what happened. Did she move the camera when she was, you know, getting ready to take the picture or whatever? Where is the rest of the man? He's not there. All I can see is his feet. So, and I swear you would get plenty of those too. So my point being that, you know, this notion that one person's mistake is another person's success. Off framing, I think, is one of the most interesting and dynamic versions, you know, of this conflict or of this tension, I should say, in terms of composition. All right, here's another one. Reflections. And here's kind of the thinking behind this one, reflection. So shop windows, for example, can be perplexing for photographers, right? And this is like something you would have read in one of those early manuals or periodicals. If you shoot straight on, you see yourself in the picture. Yet, from an angle, the surrounding environment appears in the shot. So, you know, maybe the street and the cars or, you know, people walking by, all that kind of stuff, when you shoot it from an angle. So many books recommended that you avoid this situation altogether, right? Because it's basically unsolvable. And even if you put a polarizer on that cuts down reflections, it may or may not get rid of them altogether, depending on all the angles that you're working with here. Then, next generation, more adventurous photographers began to integrate these reflections into their compositions. By doing so, they were able to show really two realities at once, right? So there's the reality of, you know, what's through the window. Let's say someone sipping their coffee in a coffee shop. And then a second reality, which might be something happening on the street. Let's say that a couple was kissing on the street. So you catch these two things. And the person drinking the coffee maybe looking the other way, which I think ideally that's what I would want in the composition. I would really want the one reality, the person not engaged with the second reality at all. And so the person sipping coffee would be looking one way. The couple kissing out on the street would be, you know, over here on the different side. And you would have all of this in one frame happening at once. So obviously you can probably figure out which camp I fall into here, because I think this is wonderful. This is dynamic and interesting. And the fact that you get a 2-for-1, especially for street photography, I think is wonderful. And it just cracks me up that there was a time when, you know, there was no vision, so to speak, you know, concerning this, what you could do with reflections, and you were just merely trying to get rid of them. So that was another one. Now, these are all from the show, right? I'm putting my own spin on them, but you know, each of these mistakes, you know, were featured at the show, and then they have examples of these mistakes, which of course are successes for many of us. All right, here's the next one. Motion blur. So the standard advice was to prevent motion blur by, you know, using a faster film or better lighting, allowing you to increase the shutter speed to stop it, to prevent it. Okay. So if you want to get rid of, this one, there are times when you do want to get rid of motion blur. The time that it bothers me the most is when I'm photographing people who are speaking, let's say in an auditorium, and the light is low and I don't want to use a flash for various reasons, and they're gesturing a lot and their hand has that motion blur. Okay, that is an instance where I don't want the motion blur, right? Because, you know, this blurry hand is distracting, especially if you're shooting someone's like, you know, president of the university or something like that. You don't want them having a blurry hand. So you have to wait until they hold that gesture for a second, grab the shot then, so the hand isn't moving, because, you know, unless you want to jack up the ISO to, you know, Lord knows what. But generally speaking, you wait for that moment. So that's an instance where you don't want motion blur. However, there are times when motion blur is interesting and can be very artistic. Artists later on discovered that blur could actually convey motion and indicate speed. So, for instance, a little bit of motion blur with a cyclist pedaling by, then suddenly you go, wow, that feels like he's going fast, right? You have that sense of speed that you wouldn't have if you just froze the shot. In other words, if you shot the cyclist pedaling by with a really fast shutter speed and you froze everything, you might get an interesting shot depending on, you know, the position of everything in the frame, but you wouldn't have that sense of motion. And sometimes you want that sense of motion, and that's where that blur comes into place. Now, what I saw at the show, I thought was even more interesting, in that motion blur was used on portraits sometimes to convey an emotional state. And these sometimes were unsettling, right? Because the emotional state usually was not a happy emotional state. So they would have someone, you know, with kind of darkish lighting, and, you know, maybe their expression was troubled, and then they would have them moving their head and they would use a slower shutter speed, and the camera would record kind of that movement, that motion back and forth. And then that really made it feel like that they were distressed or struggling, or, you know, there was something going on. And it was interesting how it could convey so much emotion just by adding this blur. I think motion blur is a very interesting technique, and it's something that I think that if you can master when you want motion and when you don't, and really think about, and I would say the cyclist being a great example, really thinking about what you want to convey, then that's very powerful. I mean, you are in control of your medium in that situation. And then taking it another step to where you start to use it to convey other things, such as emotional state, that was fascinating to me. So I thought motion blur was a great example of something that could be a mistake or really a satisfying image. Another one, this is number 4, distortion. So photographers in the early days were instructed not to position an arm or a hand or a leg closer to the lens than the other parts of the body because of the distortion that would elongate or enlarge that body part. And, you know, this is something that I'm still very mindful of today, especially with portraits. So, for instance, if you're photographing a woman with a sleeveless blouse, you do not generally want her to have one shoulder closest to the lens, because that'll make that arm, you know, that's closest to the camera, look bigger than it really is. And she's probably not going to like that very much unless she is super thin. So yeah, that's something that I still think about. Make sure that there isn't a hand too close to the lens or an arm or even a leg causing that distortion, causing that enlargement that we don't want. But it was interesting to look at images where artists also use this to really play with the image. And one shot that jumps out at me is where it was a man had his legs stretched out and he had interesting shoes on. So the photographer was positioned at the foot end, right? And then the man was trailing off in the distance there, and his feet were very dominant in the frame, you know, because they were closest to the camera. And I was looking at the shot and it was very interesting. It was dynamic. And then they also had the depth of field trail off a little bit as, you know, as we went back. So his face and the rest of his body wasn't as sharp as the feet that were right there in the foreground and that were also enlarged. And so there were some very creative uses of this distortion that I thought were fascinating. And it's funny because I had fallen into the camp most of the time of where I'm trying to avoid this, more like the situation I was talking about earlier for portraits and so forth. And it really hadn't dawned on me that I could use this camera effect creatively. And this is something now that I'm going to look for and, you know, and play with a little bit sometimes, because I liked some of the shots where they were using distortion as part of an engaging composition. The fifth one is lens flare. And by the way, there are more than five. I'm picking five of my favorites here. But the fifth one was lens flare. And photographers were cautioned about pointing their lenses in the directions of strong light sources, such as a bright lamp or the sun, because it increased the chances of lens flare. And of course, lens flare does all sorts of things. It decreases contrast. Sometimes light will bounce around within the lens, you know, disrupting the composition. Sometimes you just have this overly glowy corner of the frame because of it. You know, all sorts of stuff happens. So the instructional books are talking about how to prevent lens flare, you know, by using a lens hood, by shading the lens so that light isn't directly falling on. And I would say also that the other thing that was going on then is that the coatings on the lenses were not nearly as good as the coating on the lenses that we have today. And so the effect of lens flare could be even more devastating, unintentional lens flare, more devastating than what we would experience with today's coated optics. That being said, then, art photographers embraced lens flare because it had this really unpredictable nature to it. And you could have the same shot, you could have the same composition, and just be moving the camera a little bit, playing with lens flare, and end up with 10 different versions of that shot, every one of them different than the one before and the one after. So then suddenly people start playing with lens flare, you know, sort of eager to see how it turned out. And in the film days, of course, you had to wait until the film went through processing, you know, before you found what you had. Now, of course, you know, we can look on the back LCD and see, ooh, that's kind of cool. I'm going to move a little bit more this way or a little bit more that way. Lens flare in some situations I really like. I think it is interesting. My approach to this is that if I'm not doing something artistic or creative, if I'm really trying to capture a scene as it appears to my eye, then I try to avoid lens flare, try to stay away from it. However, especially on some portraits, and for some reason for me on high school senior portraits in particular, I like it sometimes. I really like a little bit of lens flare coming in from one side, and then, you know, that youthful face, maybe a pleasant expression, you know, that exuberance with the lens flare. It all just kind of really works together. And so one approach might be to, you know, shoot it straight without the lens flare, you know, get that series, and then take off the lens hood or you know, reposition the subject a little bit and really play with lens flare and shoot another series with it. And then I could see offering, you know, the best of both versions, you know, in the final set of images. I think lens flare is fun. It's, and I think part of the joy of lens flare is its unpredictable nature. And boy, sometimes though, when you hit it big time. So the bottom line here, other than these specific techniques, is that, you know, photography is an ever-evolving medium. And I really want to caution against following the rules too closely, because the rules change. The rules change. And, you know, the rules are, you know, based on, you know, a set of ideas, an aesthetic, you know, all sorts of stuff. And if the next generation or if another group of people don't necessarily embrace those principles, then the rules make no sense to them, right? They're going, why are you following these rules? I don't like those shots anyway, right? They're boring to me, or whatever it happens to be. So I think that we have to continue to, you know, challenge ourselves to keep an open mind, to re-examine the rules that we're following, and maybe to break them every now and then, you know, just to see what we come up with. This show, I thought, did a great job of, you know, reminding all of us of that. If you don't get to see the show, I hope that this spot here did the job in terms of getting to think a bit more about the mistakes and miscalculations that happen in photography. Sometimes they're wonderful, sometimes they're not, but you got to get in the mix and see what happens. Are you interested in what happens behind the scenes in podcasting? Well, if you want to know all the ins and outs of what it takes to create a podcast, to publish a podcast, and, you know, to promote and hopefully get some advertising revenue from a podcast, I have a workshop, an online workshop coming up in October and November. I have two dates in October and November, called Podcast Skills, and you can sign up for it at thenimblephotographer.com. All you have to do is go to www.thenimblephotographer.com, click on workshops, and both of them will be right there. One is on October 12th, the other is on November 9th, and I am going to take you all through everything that I can think of anyway that it takes to produce a podcast, something I know a little bit about, all right? So if you're fascinated, if you're interested, if you're thinking about starting your own podcast, sign up for this thing, join me. I guarantee you will learn a lot and you'll have fun as well. Speaking of podcasts, how do you listen to your podcast? And you know, this just kind of came to me the other day. And I created a poll on our inner circle. But what I did was I opened it up to everyone. So it's open to the public. And this poll is titled, How Do You Listen to Your Podcast? Then I put the different ways to listen there. You know, Apple Podcasts, Google Play Music, Overcast, Spotify, you know, Podbean. I listed a bunch of them there. And then I'm inviting people to come over and say, okay, I listen to, let's say, this podcast through Apple Music. And then someone else would go, hey, I've been using Overcast for years. I still use Overcast. That's how I listen. And you just have to click the box and you can see what everyone else has done. And then another fun part is that a lot of people are commenting as well. So then you get some comments about how they consume their podcast. I just think it's so one of those interesting sort of like, I didn't know that. Like, for instance, so far, no one has selected Google Play Music for the way that they listen to podcasts. And when Google announced that they were going to, you know, start, you know, supporting podcasts, I thought it was sort of a big deal. I made sure Digital Story was there. And so far, not one person has said that they listen to this show that way. That's the kind of stuff that you find out. If you're interested, I have a link in the show notes. Just click on it. How do you listen to your podcast? Go over and participate. Like I said, it's open to everyone. It's kind of fun. I'm going to close it this Friday, and then I'll publish the result. Alfred Stieglitz, 5 Random Don'ts. So this was also from the show at San Francisco MoMA. And so, you know, they had some of the stuff that I had talked about earlier, but then they also had this placard that had 12 random don'ts. Now, 12 was a few too many for me, and I liked some of them better than others. So I I whittled Alfred's list down to 5, and I do think that these 5 are interesting. And this is from his photographic topics number 7, January 1909 is when he published these 12 don'ts. Here are 5 of the 12 right here, and they're very interesting. And of course, Alfred Stieglitz, I believe he married Georgia O'Keeffe, or at least they were definitely an item for a long time. One of the pioneers of modern photography. Very interesting fellow. All right, here we go. Number 1, don't believe you must be a pictorial photographer. Bad pictorial photography, like bad art painting, is a crime. Number 2, don't plagiarize if you can help it. It can't give you any real pleasure to know yourself akin to a thief. I'm smiling during some of these. Just the wording alone is, you know, just wonderful. All right. So that was the second one. Here's the third one. Don't believe you became an artist the instant you received a gift Kodak on Christmas morning. Isn't that great? Don't believe you became an artist the instant you received a gift Kodak on Christmas morning. I know that doesn't apply to any of us, but we do know some folks that it applies to, right? Okay, here's the fourth one. Don't believe that experts are born. They are the results of hard work. And no truer words were ever written, right? All right, so that was the fourth one. Here's the fifth one. Don't go through life with your eyes closed. Even though you may have chosen photography as your vocation, the machine may see it for you, but its eye is dead. Your eye should furnish it with life. But don't believe that all open eyes see. Seeing needs practice, just like photography itself. Interesting, huh? That one's very interesting to me. I'm going to read it again, just because. Don't go through life with your eyes closed, even though you may have chosen photography as your vocation. The machine may see for you, but its eye is dead. Your eye should furnish it with life, but don't believe that all eyes see. Seeing needs practice, just like photography itself. Good stuff there. I think that fifth one sums up a lot of things for me. Now, and there was a P.S., by the way. So he did the 12, and then there's this P.S. Don't believe I claim any originality for the above random remarks. Okay. So that is our friend Alfred Stieglitz from San Francisco Museum of Modern Art and the show Photography, the Art of Mistakes. Thank you so much, Alfred, for those words of wisdom. Try LinkedIn Learning free for 30 days. You know, there's been this interesting thing going on for me as an online trainer and for a lot of people who started with lynda.com back in the day. I have many titles with them. And then lynda.com was bought by LinkedIn Learning, and then Microsoft bought LinkedIn Learning. And LinkedIn Learning space now contains all the stuff from Lynda, plus all sorts of additional business-oriented training topics. So it's very robust. It is the online training of the future for folks that have been in this ecosystem. Lynda.com is still around. However, over time, it will be phased out. All of my stuff is right now on both LinkedIn Learning and Lynda.com. However, LinkedIn Learning is the path to the future. So I thought, okay, I'm going to start letting folks know about LinkedIn Learning because that just makes more sense. And I want people to follow me. I want people to follow the other creatives that are on there. And I think the creative sector on LinkedIn Learning needs as much support as possible because the marketing emphasis right now for LinkedIn Learning is more business, less creative. So I thought, hey, let's get, you know, as many creatives over there, and especially people who follow creative instructors, let's get them over to LinkedIn Learning and, you know, so that those numbers go up. So you can try LinkedIn Learning free for 30 days. I have a tile on all the pages of the Digital Story. Just put that on there. So you can just click on that, and that will take you over to the page where you can start your 30-day free trial. I believe the pricing, if you go on and subscribe, the pricing is the same as it was for lynda.com. You get access to 13,000 plus expert-led courses, and you can watch as many as you want. There's no limit. And dozens of new courses are added each week across business, tech, and creative. You can watch anytime on your computer or phone. You can easily access and watch courses from your desktop or mobile device. Apps are available for iOS and Android. Some of the courses you can earn a certificate when you complete the course. Many of the courses have exercise files and quizzes and things like that. And if you download the mobile app, you can have offline viewing just like you can with Netflix. And so you can watch the courses on LinkedIn Learning without internet connection. So you could watch a course while you're traveling from the East Coast to the West Coast or something like that, flying over the pond to Europe or over to Asia. So you can download courses and actually get smart while you're traveling. So it's worth taking a look. So if you haven't done any online training for a while and you want to increase your chops here, click on the tile that's on all the pages of Digital Story. Check out LinkedIn Learning free for 30 days. Check out my courses for sure. Capture One Pro, Photos for Mac OS. I've got Luminar on there, all sorts of good stuff. And all the other, support the creative sector, but also, hey, take a look at the business stuff too. And let me know what you think, all right? A little bit of Virtual Camera Club news. First of all, big thanks to our Inner Circle members, the folks that help keep the lights on here at the Digital Story and the Nimble Photographer. By the way, I have a new Nimble Photographer artist interview going up here within the next week, so stay tuned for that. That is made possible also by our Inner Circle members. If you want to find out more about being an Inner Circle member and you want to support the show and support the endeavors of this photography community, just click on the tile that's on all the pages of the Digital Story, our Patreon tile there. Be part of the Inner Circle. And I thank our members so much for their support. Also, we have B&H and Amazon tiles on all the pages of the Digital Story. If you're going to buy some photography equipment, something we talk about here, if you click there first, then go ahead and find what you want on the sites. That helps support the show. And I also have a new tile on the site for audio equipment, too, for those of you that are audiophiles, musicians, and so forth. And finally, be sure to visit our friends at Red River Paper for all of your inkjet supply needs. They have everything. They have the tutorials, they have the paper, they have the supplies, they have the enthusiasm, which I think is very important, and they can help you become the artist that you want to be. Red River Paper, longest running supporter of the Digital Story, and they have a great Facebook page at facebook.com/redriverpaper. All right, that's going to do it for me this week. I'm heading off to Photoshop World. If you're going to be there and you want to say hey, just send me a note via the contact form on the Nimble Photographer, and we'll see if we can get together for a cup of coffee. I'm going to be looking for all sorts of interesting stuff there. I've got some great stories for next week. Come back and join me. Until then, have a great week. Bye-bye now.